We might just read a psalm together, Psalm 32, the 32nd psalm. We'll read the psalm together, this psalm, a psalm of David. In my Bible, it has got this heading, the joy of forgiveness. That's the heading in my Bible. It's called a psalm of David, a contemplation, or it could mean an instruction. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. I might just add before I read this psalm that a lot of this psalm is a dialogue between the psalmist and the Lord. And as a matter of fact, from verse 3 down to verse number 9, it is a dialogue between David the psalmist and the Lord. But it's an instructive dialogue. And it's a dialogue that we all have with the Lord. But he starts off with a word of instruction, a word of where he speaks about the joy of being forgiven. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. Now he commences his dialogue with the Lord as he remembers his own forgiveness and as he looks forward with confidence in the Lord. When I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. Selah. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. I said, I will confess my transgression to the Lord, and you forgive the iniquity of my sin. Selah. Then he looks to the future. For this cause everyone who is godly shall pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they shall not come near him. You are my hiding place. You shall preserve me from trouble. You shall surround me with songs of deliverance. Selah. And then the Lord speaks, and he says to David, I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will guide you with my eye. Do not be like the horse or like the mule, which have no understanding, which must be harnessed with bit and bridle, else they will come near you. And then David then reflects again on the contrast between those who know God's forgiveness and those who don't. Many sorrows shall be to the wicked, but he who trusts in the Lord, mercy shall surround him. Finally, it's this word of encouragement to those who know God's forgiving grace. Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, you righteous. And shout for joy, all you upright in heart. Well, I do trust that the Lord will bless this reading of this very, very wonderful psalm to each one of our hearts. This is a psalm, of course, about David reflects upon his own forgiveness and rejoices and celebrates the joy and happiness of those who know God's forgiving grace. I think in the world we live in today, I think it's a harsher world in many ways than what it was in the past. I think people are a lot harsher in their thinking. And forgiveness has become an enormous problem in our society. I came across an internet site recently. It was an atheist kind of internet site. I don't know how I stumbled across it, but you do. People who use the internet will understand what I mean. You stumble across things. Well, I stumbled across this site. And this site indicated to us that the Christian proclamation of God's forgiving grace was something that was immoral. It was immoral. And the belief that one can be forgiven for any kind of sin, it was believed, demonstrates the moral flaw of Christianity. And it gave the reason for that is, and it quoted the example of a man who was called Hans Frank. Now, he was a Nazi. He was the Governor General of Poland during World War II. And in that role, he was complicit in the murder of millions of Polish people and Jews. He was a very bad man. And he was responsible for the deaths of millions of people. Not directly, but he was part of that process. He was a ruthless, brutal man. He was arrested and tried for war crimes at the conclusion of the Second World War, and he was sentenced to death at the Nuremberg trials. But in the intervening period, during his the time of his trial and in the intervening period, it says that he returned to the Christian faith of his childhood years and expressed grief, remorse for his deeds. And he said before he died, "I am thankful for the kind treatment during my captivity, and I ask God to accept me with mercy." Now, I don't know whether the man was genuine in his repentance or not, but I would believe it's possible that if the man humbled himself before the Lord and turned to the Lord looking for forgiveness, God would have forgiven him. Now, that's the point this site made. That is immoral. That this man could spend his life committing such terrible sins and then in the weeks before his death simply say, "God, I'm sorry," and God forgives it all. The authors of this particular site felt that that was immoral. And I've noticed that increasingly in today's world, forgiveness is a thing that people struggle with. I read a very interesting comment in relation to Hillary Clinton. And you remember, those of us my age certainly can remember the Clinton era. Bill Clinton was the president of the United States, and he wasn't what you'd call a moral man in terms of his sexual ethics. In my view, he was a very great president, actually, despite that. But Hillary Clinton was greatly criticized by the feminist movement in the United States for forgiving her husband. And she was basically said, it is wrong for a wife to forgive her husband who is unfaithful to her. That's the kind of struggles that people are having with the subject of forgiveness. You don't forgive. And I think Christians are increasingly struggling with the idea of forgiving someone. I think it's a very, very widespread problem. And sometimes we talk very glibly about it. But forgiveness, being forgiven and forgiving someone, is a very great thing. And in fact, the Bible puts it this way, if God has forgiven us, now, I mean, when you look out there in the world, we talk about people outside there who are not Christians, who are not regenerate, who don't know the Lord. I can certainly understand what they think about forgiveness. I can understand that atheist side. I totally can understand where they're coming from. They don't know the grace of God. And therefore, they're thinking in a human sense, and I can understand that. But for Christians, the New Testament takes a viewpoint. There is absolutely no excuse for a Christian not being willing to forgive because of the immensity of God's forgiveness towards us. And that's what David here celebrates, God's amazing forgiveness. And so you'll notice in verses 1 and 2, he just explains and describes the happiness. How blessed is someone who has been forgiven by God? How happy is that person? Now, we take that very simply. We're all forgiven people here this morning. And because of that, we should be people that are intensely joyful and happy. And if we're not, it's because we're not living in the joy of God's wonderful forgiveness. Now, you notice that David makes three statements about forgiveness. We might say that this follows the pattern of Hebrew poetry, where in verses 1 and 2, you kind of get a little kind of part of this psalm. You get three statements which we would call are synonymous. They seem to be, they say just the same thing in different ways. And the last statement we say is synthetic. In other words, he now builds upon that and makes a statement about the consequence of forgiveness of our life. You'll notice he mentions three kinds of what we're forgiven from. He says, blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity. So he uses three words, first of all, to describe what God has forgiven. And I think what he's doing there in this beautiful poetry, it is Old Testament poetry, he is showing the extensiveness of divine forgiveness. Whatever kind of sin it is, God has completely forgiven us. So you might think of transgression, which means passing over the boundary. God sets boundaries. He set boundaries for his people Israel. Within those boundaries, they could live, they could enjoy life, they could worship the Lord, but he says, you must not go beyond these boundaries. But he says, blessed is he who's going beyond those boundaries is forgiven. And David is saying, I went beyond the boundaries, but God forgave me. And then you can think of the word sin, which means missing the mark or missing God's way. God has given us the way to live. We miss the way, we take the wrong way. But he says, God has covered that over. And you can think of iniquity, which means perversity or injustice. To do something that is perverse, unfair, unjust, characterized by greed or what, ruthlessness or anything like that. And he says, I acted that way, but God, he's not putting it to my account. Now, I don't think David wants us to linger and define these things and try and work it all out. I think he's just showing the extensiveness. Whatever kind of sin it is, God has forgiven us. That's the greatness of divine forgiveness. And then you'll notice in describing the reality of being forgiven, he uses three different words. He talks about transgression being forgiven, sin being covered, and blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity. So he uses another three verbs. And he says, you know, God has forgiven us, he has covered our sin, and he does not hold us to account for it. He hasn't debited our sin to our account. Well, it was, but he's cleared the debt. The debt is completely cleared. So they're a very, very beautiful way to really describe the reality of forgiveness. That it's not partial, it's total, and it's complete. And he's finding a way, uses three words to give expression to that. The completeness of our forgiveness. Forgiven, covered, and he says, not debited to our account. We are completely free. And then he goes on into the consequence of that forgiveness. And he says, and in whose spirit there is no guile. Now, I would say that's a result of when you're forgiven, what actually happens is you are freed completely from hypocrisy. God clears all guile from us. An unforgiven person who stands in the presence of the Lord to worship him is acting in a hypocritical manner. But a person who may have failed miserably in their life, and they may have wandered and strayed from the Lord, if they have confessed their sin before the Lord, and they're forgiven, they can stand in the Lord's presence, and they can worship the Lord, and no one can point the finger at them and say, you are a hypocrite. 6 months ago you were doing this, that, or the other thing. You have no right to be there. A person who's forgiven can say, yes, it's true. I did sin. I did go the wrong way. But God has forgiven me. God has cleansed me. And now I can stand before him and worship him. So a person who's forgiven is a spirit who inwardly, in their spirit, God has cleansed them. The word deceit there is the word guile. He has cleansed them from all falsehood and for all guile. Because what does forgiveness do? It does two things. It wipes the slate clean. That's using an expression when we don't use slates anymore, but you know what I mean. In the days in school, before my time, they used to use slates and then you'd wipe them with a wet rag and that would wipe all the writing off it. Well, and that expression has come into the English language, wiping the slate clean. Well, what does God do when he forgives us? He wipes the slate clean. He just gives it, it gives us, as it were, our lives like a blank sheet. And not only that, does he wipe the slate clean as we look back, all the past is forgiven, but he gives us a new start. So we have a new start, the past is wiped away, and David says, I can therefore worship the Lord, and I'm not a hypocrite anymore. I can stand before him, in whose spirit there is no guile. So a person that's forgiven is without guile, and that's wonderful. And if they continue in that way, of course, that will characterize their life as a life without guile, something to be very wonderful. But as David makes this great statement, he then reflects on his own forgiveness and looks back and remembers the time that he was forgiven. And he thinks, and possibly he's thinking of his, I don't know what time of his life he's thinking about. Many commentators believe he's thinking about the great sin he committed in relation to Uriah the Hittite and Bathsheba, his double sin of murder, adultery, and followed by murder, a very, very serious sin that he committed. It's interesting, you know, according to the Old Testament, you know, presumptuous sin. There was no forgiveness for sins of presumption under the Old Testament law. In other words, the sin offering did not cover deliberate sin. What the Catholics would call mortal sin did not have. There was no scope in the Old Testament ritual for forgiveness. The sin offering didn't cover that. It only covered sins of ignorance. David, by committing these sins that he committed, they were, if we use that language, they were mortal sins. They were serious sins. And what David did was, what all did in Old Testament times, it wasn't by, like in the Psalm 51, he said, sacrifice an offering you would not. He says, there's no use me offering a sacrifice. What he did was he cast himself upon the mercy of God, and God forgave him. And that's all you can do. When you've sinned, the only thing we can do is to cast ourselves completely upon the mercy of God. And that's what David did. But as he looks back, he remembers this time, and in verse 2, 3 and 4, he remembers the painful experience of the conviction of sin. It was a time of lamentation in his life. He says, when I kept silent, in other words, he had not confessed his sin, but my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. I went through a period in which I groaned over my behavior, in which I was full of lamentation. He says, for day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. Here's a period of conviction and a period of chastisement. I think too often one of the things that is very much lacking, I think, today, another thing we said, we struggle for forgiveness, but another thing that's very lacking, I think, is a real conviction about sin. It used to be said, you know, when I was young growing up, no conversion without conviction. A person needed to be convicted of their sin. And as I, as a young man, looking back, I can remember the gospel preachers used to really emphasize the need for a person to be really convicted that they were sinful. They needed salvation. Now, David did not come to forgiveness lightly. He went through a process of conviction, of lamenting, of remembering his sin. And I think too often we're making it too press button style. You know, oh well, I've committed the sin. Okay, right, okay, God, I confess it. I'm forgiven. Hallelujah. Off I go. And there's no reflection on the seriousness of what we have done. The sense of failure. Pride, and our pride is demolished. And we think of the pain we have caused. And the dishonor we have done to the name of the Lord. And the damage that we have done to others. We reflect upon it. And we lament within ourselves what we have done. It's conviction. David records that. He remembers that. But then he came through that time when he says three things. He says in verse 5, I acknowledged my sin unto you, and my iniquity have I not hidden. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. So there comes a point as he's lamenting and feeling the weight of his sin and what he's done, and remembering all the damage it's done and the pain it's caused, the sorrow. And there's real conviction. He comes to this point where he says, I did three things. I acknowledged my sin. I uncovered it. And I confessed it. That's very, very important, isn't it? First of all, to acknowledge, you make no excuses for it. He didn't say, well, you know, it was hard for me. It was this and that and the other thing. And we all loved it. Human beings are the greatest. We are amazing at the way we can justify ourselves, the excuses we make for ourselves. And we're brilliant at it. We're imaginative, creative. It's one of the most creative things about human beings is the way we make excuses for ourselves. We're very, very creative in that way. But David said, I'm not making excuses. I'm acknowledging my sin. He's not blaming others. He's blaming himself. He uncovered it. So he's not going to bury it somewhere in his memory. He says, I uncovered it completely. I just lifted the lid. There was my sin. Lord, I have sinned. He's not burying it somewhere in some corner of his brain. And then he says, he confessed it. I owned up to the guilt. I took ownership of this sin. It's my sin. I committed it. I'm responsible. And I came before you confessing my sin. One of the things that human beings do, and this is very, very sad, you know, and you find this very often in things like when there's strife in a church, you always find this, you know, it's one of the invariable things you'll find. Marriage breakup is another example, though you always find this. It's how people rewrite history and write them in, themselves in, as having been not in the wrong. You get, you know, I've seen, and look, it's terrible things that can happen amongst Christians when there's strife. You know the old saying, strife comes into a church, strife comes in the first front door, love goes out the back door sort of thing. And it's true. And people do things and say things and say horrible things about one another. And really, it's quite awful how Christians can descend into such mudslinging when there's strife. But I've always invariably found this, that about 6 months after the strife, history is rewritten. And both sides are writing themselves as being the faithful ones, the good ones, the ones that did the right thing. The other side of there, that's where all the bad things were. They did all the bad things, we did all the good things. That's exactly the opposite of what David did. It's the same with marriage breakdown. Sometimes, you know, when there's problems in marriage, it's very easy for each party to write themselves, rewrite their history in their mind, so I'm the good person, I'm the wrong person, I'm the victim, I'm the whatever. But it's very hard for any of us to, as it were, just not rewrite history. Not write the history in the way we want it to sound. But to honestly take ownership and say, I have sinned. And to acknowledge it, we uncover it, and we confess it. And when that happened, what it says here, when I did this, I acknowledged, I went through this process of sorrow and chastisement, and I went through this process of conviction and lamenting what I have done. He said, I came to this point where I acknowledged it. I did not hide it. I uncovered it. I confessed it. And it says, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. You forgave me. I'm completely forgiven. The slate was written free. And then as he continues this contemplation and this dialogue with the Lord, he's speaking to the Lord, but it's just a kind of poetic device in which he says, this is my conversation with the Lord. And really, it's a conversation we've all had. Isn't that right? It reflects the conversation that those who have been forgiven have had with the Lord. And then as he thinks of this, he looks forward to the future. So he's looked back to his own forgiveness, and now he looks forward with confidence and faith. I can look forward to the future. I have nothing to fear anymore. I'm forgiven. That's the wonderful thing about being forgiven. Because if you're a forgiven person, then you've nothing to fear in the future. God is for us. Who can be against us? That's what Paul said, and we have had reference twice to Romans chapter 8. There's therefore no condemnation to them that are in Christ Jesus. We're forgiven. No condemnation. And as he comes to the end of Romans chapter 8, he says, well, who shall condemn us? Who can condemn us? God's forgiven us. You know, Christ died. Who shall condemn us now, he says? God's for us. Who can be against us? Confidence. Trust. That's what David says. David looks forward to the future. He says, for this cause, and I think it's because of forgiveness, because of God's forgiving grace, for this cause everyone who is godly shall pray to you. So we pray in confidence. We believe in God. I can pray with confidence. We talk to, when we've got a bad conscience, well, we can't pray. Isn't that right? We all know that. Our conscience is bad. There's things we haven't confessed, things we haven't put right. You know, and I don't think forgiveness is ever detached from putting right what we've done wrong, where you can. Sadly, there are some actions that we do we can't put right. And that's terrible. Other actions we can. Other actions perhaps don't have ramifications for other people in that same sense. But always, confession of sin always involves putting it right. So when a person has put right their sin, they've confessed their sin to the Lord, well then you can pray. And pray with confidence. Because you know that you've been forgiven. So he says, for this cause everyone who is godly shall pray to you in a time of trouble, in a time when you may be found. And I think that's just simply a way of saying the time when God, generally it's an amazing thing, is in times of trouble. That we really feel that and feel that God is near to us, a time when he can be found. He's there for us. I think it's a way of David saying, for this cause, everyone who is godly shall pray to you. Because in times of trouble, we're very conscious that you're there for us. they be found. He goes on and he says, surely in a flood of great waters, they shall not come near him. In other words, you know, this person feels safe and secure in the love of God. And then David, he's speaking generally there, but in verse 7 he reflects upon this again and he says, well, you know, and he talks about his own personal, what he himself discovered. You are my hiding place, he says. You're my hiding place. He said, you shall preserve me from trouble. You shall surround me with songs of deliverance. He's looking to the future with this incredible sense of confidence. You're my hiding place. That's the title of a book, isn't it? Corrie Ten Boom, wasn't it, wrote that book, You're My Hiding Place. She spent time in a concentration camp during the Second World War under the Nazi regime of Adolf Hitler. She wrote that book, The Hiding Place, drawn from this verse here. You are my hiding place, is God, the one in whom I can trust. You shall preserve me from trouble. I don't think he's saying I won't have any more trouble in my life. No, troubles are going to come, but you'll preserve me in the midst of my troubles. And he says, you will surround me with songs of deliverance. I know that I shall have constant songs of deliverance from the Lord because he's been forgiven. So there's a backward look of remembering what we once were, how God forgave us, and then a forward look of confidence because we've been forgiven. We can fully trust in the Lord. And then in verses number 8 and 9, we get the Lord then comes in and speaks now, and he speaks to David, and he says to David, I will instruct you, I'll educate you. Yeah, God is under, for one who's forgiven and has put their life in God's hand, God makes these commitments. He says, I'll educate you. I'm going to educate you in the way you should be. He says, I'll guide you. It's the other thing he says, I will guide you with my eye. Two very, very wonderful things. And then in verse 9, his appeal is, do not rebel against me. Do not go against me. He talked in the earlier passage about the boundaries God has set. Don't go beyond those boundaries. The way in which he's called us to walk, don't go on your own way. Or iniquity and perversity, don't go down that road. He says to him, do not be like the horse or like the mule, which have no understanding, which must be harnessed with bit and bridle, else they will not come near. Don't follow that way. Walk in my ways. So to every forgiven person, God makes this appeal. It's the appeal that Jesus made. Go and sin no more. That's what the Lord said to the woman. Remember, the Pharisees brought that woman who had been found in the act of adultery. And when he forgave her, he says, go and sin no more. He said to the man by that pool in Jerusalem after he healed him, go and sin no more. That's how God says. When God forgives us, he says, go and sin no more. Now, of course, in saying that, we will fail as believers, but the wonderful thing is, God is still always ready there to forgive. But still, his appeal to us is, do not be like the horse or like the mule that have to be restrained. Don't be like that. Follow in my ways. So he says, I undertake to educate you, and I will guide you with my eye. And I think guiding a person with their eye is how the hymn writer probably puts it. There's a hymn, isn't it? I will guide you, I will guide you, I will guide you with my eye. Actually, the thought is, I will guide you with my eye upon you. My eye will be upon you, and I will guide you through life. You know, in the sense of that close observation of what's happening in our life. Then, when he comes down then to verse number 10, he just simply makes this very, very wonderful thing as he reflects on forgiving, his own forgiveness. He then comes out of this dialogue with the Lord, and he kind of makes this very instructive statement. He says, many sorrows shall be to the wicked, but he who trusts in the Lord, mercy shall surround him. So a forgiven person is a person who trusts in the Lord. A person who trusts in the Lord is a forgiven person. And he says, mercy shall surround them. So there's two ways in life. There's the way of the wicked, the willful. Take their own ways. It's like what the Lord said in Matthew chapter 7. The broad way that goes down to destruction. The narrow way that leads to life. We're just constantly faced with these two ways. Wherever we're reading about, Moses said to the people of Israel, behold, I set before you the way of life, the way of death. David's referring to that with his own words. He says, many sorrows shall be to those who go down that way. But he says, those who are on the Lord's way, forgiven, they've confessed their sin, they have acknowledged their guilt. He who trusts in the Lord, mercy shall surround him. So he contrasts in this, he contrasts here the idea of many sorrows, mercy surrounding us. It's a choice, isn't it? We either go down the way of many sorrows or the way of surrounding mercy.